And we'll read this morning John chapter 15, verses 1 through 8. I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away, and every branch that bears fruit, he prunes it, that it may bear more fruit. You are already clean because of the word which I have spoken to you. Abide in me, and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit of itself unless it abides in the vine, so neither can you unless you abide in me. I am the vine, you are the branches. He who abides in me and I in him, he bears much fruit. For apart from me, you can do nothing. If anyone does not abide in me, he is thrown away as a branch and dries up, and they gather them and cast them into the fire, and they are burned. If you abide in me and my words abide in you, ask whatever you wish, and it shall be done for you. By this is my Father glorified, that you bear much fruit, and so prove to be my disciples. This morning, we'll really just consider the first verse here. I myself jumped ahead in the text right away and started thinking about this abiding in the vine and that kind of thing, and bearing much fruit, which is a very preacherly thing to do. You always worry about those who listen to you, that they're going to put it to use in their life, that they're going to think about, I hate to put it this way, but preachers go pretty low sometimes. We think about, we want the congregation to be improving themselves. But I don't think that's the first thing we should look at in this text. Ourselves. Verse 1, just really want to stress this here. This verse 1, I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser. Let's not even think about ourselves for a little while. Now, this is where the context comes maybe important, and I'm going with it. In chapter 14, verse 31, remember what we said last week? Jesus says to his disciples, arise or get up. Have y'all ever said to get up to somebody? That's what he says, get up, let's go. And he says, get up, let's go from here. And then in John chapter 18, verse 1, it says, and when Jesus had spoken these words, he went forth with his disciples over the ravine of the Kidron, where there was a garden into which he himself entered and his disciples. Now remember what we said last week. The alternatives here is that he stayed longer. Even though he said, get up, let's go, he hung around and said more stuff. A lot more stuff. Chapter 15 through the end of that wonderful prayer. Or some people think he spoke more to them somewhere in between. As Jesus made his way through the darkened streets of Jerusalem, he spoke some of these things and prayed this prayer. And this is where historical, biblical geography and scriptures intersect. By the way, do y'all like geography? Did y'all like geography in school? Huh? What's that, Steve?
Not enough.
Not enough? Yeah. You like coloring maps, though, didn't you? Oh, man. That's probably the only part I made A's in. Man, I made some maps. Just right down my alley. But it's locating things, and what's the difference? And real geographers are really into land use and what goes on in the land and how the, you know, what's under the land, or their oil reserves under the land, and you know, can you dig copper out of those hills? All that stuff is a part of geography. And so this is where geography and historical, biblical geography and scriptures intersect, I think. It's a possibility anyway here, and we're going to consider just a moment or two. Jesus and his disciples would no doubt pass near Herod's temple as they went across. Probably they would cross through the Golden Gate. But there was a gate on the city walls that led down the Kidron Valley across into Gethsemane. That's a little geography there. And if Jesus somehow made his way and the disciples made their ways through Jerusalem that night, they very likely could have just come right past and maybe even entered the temple. We don't know that. But Josephus, who's no Christian, and he doesn't even reference Jesus here, but it's helpful that he told us what the temple was like. There between the court of the Gentiles, which wasn't really part of the temple proper at all, that no Jew would think of the court of the Gentiles as really being part of the temple. And so if they had gone in there at that gate there was an elaborate golden grapevine twisting all around that gate. And we know that because of Josephus, who was a Benedict Arnold par excellence. He was supposed to die. He was fighting for the Jews when the Jews fought against Rome up in Galilee area, and he was fighting with his compatriots against the Romans, and they were going to be captured. And so the deal was they would kill each other and not be captured and, you know, die a glorious death for the sake of Israel. But when it got down to the final two, Josephus and his buddy said, let's don't do this. And so he didn't, and he was really a wonderful writer, and he wrote two great histories, the Jewish Antiquities and the Great War between Rome and Israel. And we find out so much from Josephus, and we're just kind of thankful that he told us about this golden vine. Did you know there were golden plates on the temple? All around the outside of the temple proper until you got up to the high point where there was white marble. Golden plates. And when the sun hit it all day long from all the different directions, the place would just glisten. It's good we know that. But at any rate, some people think that vine precipitated or suggested to Jesus' mind saying, I'm the true vine. It's possible. A fellow named Westcott, who I really like, an English fellow from Oxford, says they would have very likely been pruning grapevines over on Olivet and burning those vines in fires over across on that mountain. And the smell of that smoke would be kind of wafting through the streets of Jerusalem. That's all just subjection and geography and maybe. But one way or the other, if Jesus indeed went into the temple, and that's where he prayed the high priestly prayer with his disciples, the temple was open all 24/7, and he could have gone in there with his disciples. It was quiet there, and he could have prayed that prayer and finished the rest of this discourse there. I don't know. Or he may have done it back in that first room. But it makes it interesting, doesn't it? This vine business. And so Jesus says, I am. And it's emphatic. I am the true vine. The I is emphatic. I am the true vine. I'm just saying it exactly, literally, what it says. He's not being suggestive here. He's not being subtle. Jesus is saying, I am the true vine. And these I am sayings, I don't know. Steve, have you preached through the I am sayings? When'd you do that? A long time, shaking his head. About time you can do it again. You know, the Bible, do we ever get finished with this? No. Isn't that wonderful? Now, there are these I am sayings in John's Gospels. There are seven of them. Jesus says, I am the bread of life. That's in chapter 6 of John's Gospel. In chapter 8, he says, I am the light of the world. In chapter 10, verses 11, and he repeats himself in 14, he says, I am the good shepherd. And by the way, these are all emphatic statements. I mean, he's bearing down on the word I. In the Greek language, this is one of the first things they tell you when they flunk you out of Greek, that the word I is not needed in a verb. You don't have to say I am going. It's the pronoun I is suggested in the verb. I know that sounds complicated to you. Is that, it doesn't? Good. And so when he does say I, when the scripture does say I there, it's being emphatic. He doesn't have to say the pronoun I, but he does. He's being emphatic here. Jesus is saying, I am the bread of life. I am the light of the world. I am the good shepherd. In chapter 11, he says, I am the resurrection and the life. In chapter 14, I am the truth and the life. The way, the truth, and the life. And finally, in this text, the last of the seven I am sayings, he says, I am the vine. And he repeats it in verse 5. Do you think Jesus wanted us to be clear about who he was? Yes, he did. And I love what C.S. Lewis always said. We always love and say Jesus is a wonderful teacher, a lover of men, but we don't believe this God business. That's something Christians added. And C.S. Lewis always would say, look, you can't say that. Because the same Jesus tells us about love and kindness and being good to each other is the one that said he was God. You can't pick and choose. I am the bread of life. I am. Don't you just love it when we take the Lord's Supper? I want you to know I love the way we do it. You know why? I get to watch each individual one of you going up there and feeding spiritually. Not literally, but I mean spiritually, not the bread, on Jesus. Each one of us go and take a hold of the bread of life. And it's a wonderful, don't we all have to do it? It's not ceremonial. It's a wonderful picture of what each one of us do. We're a hungry lot. I rarely am not hungry. I'm just about always hungry. It's my rearing, my upbringing. I figured if I didn't eat fast and always eat, my brothers and sister would get everything. So I was always hungry. But we are a hungry lot. Jesus is the bread of life, the light of the world. I'm stomping around on this. Jesus wants us to know who he is. I'm the good shepherd. Oh, poor wandering one. You need a shepherd. I am the resurrection. As men face death, and I want you to know I live across the street from a cemetery, he is the resurrection. All those graves except a few oddballs are facing east where Jesus shall appear. Every once in a while over there, there's somebody that's kind of facing north or south. And they usually do that because they're trying to cram another grave into a little spot. But the point is, he is the resurrection. I am the way. He's a road to life. And finally, Jesus is the vine. And Jesus wants his disciples to be not mistaken about who he is. Doesn't Jesus fill up 1,000 metaphors? Oh, for 1,000 tongues to sing my great Redeemer's praise. Men could just go on and on. Could we with ink the ocean fill, and were the skies of parchment made, were for every stalk on earth a quill, and every man a scribe by trade, to write the love of God would drain the ocean dry, nor could the scroll contain the whole, though stretched from sky to sky. Men, there's all of these things that could be said about Jesus. Have men said all that they will yet say about Jesus? Not yet. But in this case, we're not talking about men saying things about Jesus. We're talking about what Jesus says about himself. We should pay very close attention. Here Jesus says he fills up this metaphor of the vine. And in this, he's contrasting himself with a vine that does not measure up to reality. I am the true vine. The Old Testament was full of vineyard analogies, and they could all be boiled down into a contrast. That the children of Israel never quite measured up to God's intention for them. I'm going to read them to you. Hosea chapter 10, verse 1. Israel is a luxurious vine. He produces fruit for himself. Whew. It makes me think of that horrible statement that man can tend to even the private devotions of his life, spiritual life. That means praying and giving and doing all these things. Even though he's doing it privately, inwardly, he's building up praise for himself. Whew. Do you ever do things that you're just kind of saying when you do it, you kind of go, I'm good. It's a terrible thing. But here, Israel, now Hosea says he produces fruit for himself. That is a vine. Isaiah chapter 5, verse 1 through 2. Let me now sing for my well-beloved a song for my beloved concerning his vineyard. My well-beloved had a vineyard on a fertile hill. Then he expected it to produce good grapes, but it produced only worthless ones. By the way, just above there, that wonderful verse where it says, in that day the branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth will be the pride and the adornment of the survivors of Israel. Jesus is the branch. Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 21. Yet I planted a choice vine, a completely faithful seed. How then have you turned yourselves before me and turned into a degenerate shoot of a foreign vine? Whew. God does so much for us, and we pervert ourselves before him and the use of his blessings before him. We always seem to turn even his blessings against him. I read this last week, and what's the current Pope's name? I forget that fella's name. I should know it. I know Benedict. I always remember him. I kind of like Benedict.
Francis.
Yeah. Boy, he laid into him this last week. He said, we have turned human sexuality against God. Whew. And human sexuality is a gift to us. But what have we done? So we are so capable of evil, as it says here. Now then, you have turned yourself before me into a degenerate shoot of a foreign vine. We turn God. We are this vine that God planted. And somehow we always ended up, Israel always ended up disappointing God. None of these verses are positive. Not a single one of these Old Testament allusions of Israel being the vine are positive allusions. They're all negative, which is very interesting. But Israel considered itself the vine, and that's why it was over that ornamental, golden ornamental vine over the temple wall door, the gate. Ezekiel chapter 15, verses 1 and 2. Then the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Son of man, how was the wood of the vine better than any wood of a branch which is among the trees of the forest? In verse 4, he says it should be put in the fire and burned. In other words, what is Israel different from any other branch in the forest? They're just like the rest of the world. We looked for the church, and it was in the world. Ezekiel chapter 19, verses 10 through 14. Your mother was like a vine in your vineyard, planted by the waters. It was fruitful and full of branches because of the abundant waters. And it had strong branches fit for scepters, for rulers. And its height was raised above the clouds, so it would have been seen in its height with a mass of its branches. This is all literary, isn't it? Have y'all ever seen a vine that big? But it was plucked up in fury. It was cast to the ground, and the east wind dried up its fruit. Its strong branches were torn off so that it withered. The fire consumed it. And now it is planted in the wilderness in a dry and thirsty land, and fire has gone out from its branches. It has consumed its shoots so that there's not a strong branch there, a scepter for a scepter to rule. This is a lamentation. Jeremiah is weeping over the state of Israel. Psalm 80, verses 8 through 14. Thou didst remove a vine from Egypt. Thou didst drive out the nations and didst plant it. Thou didst clear the ground before it. It took deep root and filled the land. The mountains were covered with its shadow, and the cedars of God with its boughs. It was sending out its branches to the sea, its shoots to the river. Why hast thou broken down its hedges, so that all who pass by pick its fruit? A boar from the forest eats its way through this little vineyard that the psalmist is writing about. And whatever moves in the field feeds on it. O God of hosts, turn again now, we beseech thee. Look down from heaven and see and take care of this vine. Just again, all of these figures of the Old Testament, there is not a single place when the writers of the Old Testament refer to Israel as the vine, there's not a single place where Israel lives up to it. It's interesting, isn't it? And what does Jesus say? He didn't look at the disciples and he doesn't speak of Israel. Who is the true vine? He is. It's like all of Israel has poured itself into Jesus, and Jesus is the perfect fulfillment of what God intended for the nations of Israel. Jesus is the absolute fulfillment of the symbolism and the metaphor of this vine business. And in reality, he is the fulfillment to all of God's expectations for Israel and all of mankind. You can just drop the idea of the vine and just say about Jesus, Jesus is what men should have been. This is what mankind should have been. This is what Israel should have been. This is what the Philistines should have been. This is what the Babylonians should have been. This is what America should be. We should be like him. So Jesus is contrasting himself. I am the vine. Does it say that? True vine. True vine. Very emphatic. Look at men. Failed, worthless. He produces fruit for himself. Consuming God's blessings with no thought of God himself. Producing bad grapes. Now the next verses teach us how to bear fruit. But first and foremost, Jesus is the true vine. All men fail except Jesus. I just made a pretty strong statement. All men fail except Jesus. He is the true vine. We are worthy of burning in the fire. Jesus saves us from that. Revive us, O Lord, Psalm 80 again. Revise us, and we will call upon thy name. O Lord of hosts, restore us. Cause thy face to shine upon us, and we will be saved. Saved from what? The burning. I think I could go around and abstractly, all of us, every single one in the room, if I questioned you, you would answer right. Do you deserve the fire? Have there been times when you produced worthless grapes or no grapes at all, and if you did, you consumed them on yourself? Have you ever spurned the good gifts of God? In fact, I think every one of us would say yes. And then I would say, do you deserve to be lopped off and pitched on the fire? I think we ought all say yes. And so the psalmist says, verse 14, look down from heaven and see and take care of this vine, even the shoot which thy right hand has planted. And listen, this little evangelical verse, and the son whom thou hast strengthened for thyself. And now we look to the second part of this verse. And Jesus says, my Father is the vine keeper. Ultimately, this great work of salvation that men participate in is really involves only two. The vine and the vine keeper, who is the Father. All of salvation was really worked out between Jesus and his Father. All the rest of it we partake in by grace. They produced this gift to mankind. Jesus is the vine keeper or the gardener. And Jesus, he had complete fidelity to his Father. They were simpatico. There was never a discordant note. Is that okay to say that? Discordant note. And Jesus, his whole life, looked to his Father to do exactly what his Father wanted him to do. And his Father would direct him. Sometimes they were difficult places, but the Father led the Son each step of the way, and Jesus was a perfect vine. You and I will perish in the fire apart from the vine and the vine keeper. Cause thy face to shine upon us, the psalmist says, and we will be saved. As we think of Jesus looking at that golden trailing vine maybe at the temple gate or the fragrance of burning vines drifting in the air over Mount Olivet, I think we need to not go directly to the idea, oh, let's bear fruit so we don't get this condemnation of the fire. No. We should first look at Jesus. I think only as this wonderful fertilizer, you might say, gets into our soul, will we be inclined to produce fruit. For the glory of the Father. So let verse 1 ring in your ear. May it be a kind of like that, a bell. I like bells. I like church bells. May the sound of this bell, I am the vine. My Father is the vine keeper. We should let that ring in our ear. Okay, and next week we'll talk about we ourselves bearing much fruit.